Hello, I'm Alex Amon, your non-binary host, and this is the 62nd episode of The Art of Asymmetrical Warfare. Today we'll be talking about the Provisional Government's final attempts to avoid civil war. First, a few plugs. If you missed last month's virtual book club, don't worry. We'll be meeting again this month on April 27th at 12 p.m. Central Time. We'll be reading two poetry collections by two Palestinian authors. The first poetry collection is called Before the Next Bomb Drops by Remy Karnazi. It's a really, really, really powerful collection of poems. It talks about being part of the Palestinian diaspora and the connection between the Palestinian fight for liberation with Black Lives Matters and all other liberation movements. And then the second poetry collection we'll be reading is Blood Orange by Yaffa. Yaffa is a transgender Palestinian activist and writer, and Blood Orange is their latest poetry collection. And again, it's really beautiful, and it's about being Palestinian, being part of the diaspora, but also the LGBTQ+ perspective. A sign up for the book club newsletter to receive the Zoom calendar invite for our virtual discussion on April 27th, and the discussion questions. Also, if you've enjoyed my current season on the Irish Civil War, or you found last season about Central Asia during the Russian Civil War fascinating, please become a member of my Patreon. If you can't join, I totally understand, but I'd really appreciate if you could leave a review or share my podcast with someone else that you know who might find my content interesting. And now it's time for Making History. Of course, now and forever, we'll be talking about Palestine. Before diving into the many actions that are taking place between now and at least June, I want to take a moment and sit with all the horrendous news we've been seeing the last few weeks. This entire genocide has been horrific, and that can make us numb to each new atrocity. We have to fight that numbness because that's how the enablers of genocide win. We grow numb, we stop protesting, and then we forget who was involved, and we pretend it never happened. We have to resist that. We can't let that happen again. So I wanted to take a moment and acknowledge the horror of Israel's assault on the Al-Shifa hospital. Palestinian health workers have just started exhuming the many corpses from the mass graves that surround what remains of the hospital. Based on the photos, videos, and stories shared by Palestinians on the ground, many of the bodies being exhumed were either dumped in mass graves after being killed, or they were just left above ground to rot and decay. A number of them seem to have been crushed by Israeli tanks, making them impossible to identify, which is horrifying but not really that surprising considering Israel has had a history of running over protesters and Palestinians with tanks and bulldozers. And according to an article by NPR, during the two-week siege of Al-Shifa, 21 patients died in the hospital and 1,000 patients were trapped inside without food, water, or medical care. So the number of dead is going to grow because people had wounds that needed to be treated, but they couldn't be treated, so they're probably now infectious. Or they'll die from starvation or dehydration. Members of the hospital staff, including the chief engineer of the maintenance department, the head of pharmaceuticals, and a reconstructive surgeon along with his mother, were killed in the hospital. There's no evidence of Hamas ever being in Al-Shifa Hospital, same as the last time Israel attacked the hospital, I think it was October, November, when this assault started. I also want to acknowledge the murder of 7 World Central Kitchen Aid workers. It is a terrible tragedy, and they are the most recent of aid workers to be murdered. Israel has purposely targeted aid workers and aid trucks since the genocide started. Israel has also purposely closed Palestine's borders and refused to allow aid to be shared with the starving and suffering Palestinians. This is a genocide. This isn't a war. This isn't a conflict. This isn't complicated. Right now, what is happening in Palestine is a live-streamed genocide. And if you have been and continue to remain silent, you are complicit. If you are looking for ways to help, go to the United States for Palestinian Rights website. They have a number of campaigns they are running that they need our help with, and they have a page dedicated to local protests. In Chicago alone, we have 5 events coming up this week. The first event is on April 13th, the March on the Democratic National Convention, which is happening in Chicago. So the march on that convention is holding an all-day conference to discuss roles, needs, and goals of the August march against the convention. So if you're interested in attending the Audis March, I recommend you go to the April 13th all-day conference so you have all the information you need. On April 14th, Healthcare Workers Stand with Palestine will be protesting outside the American Medical Association Board of Trustees meeting at 11 a.m. at AMA headquarters, 330 North Wabash Street. Three major events are happening on April 15th. First, April 15th is a nationwide strike, so no work, no school, no spending. Second, the USCPR, the United States Campaign for Palestinian Rights, is hosting a Tats Day webinar called No More Money for Israel's Crimes. And also on April 15th, Boeing Arms Genocide Campaign is coming to Chicago. Basically, Governor Pritzker, who has not called for a ceasefire and actually reprimanded Chicago for our ceasefire resolution, wants to continue investing in Boeing and keeping its multi-million-dollar drone facility here in Illinois. The Boeing Arms Genocide Group will be hosting an art build at Second Unitarian Church of Chicago from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. on April 15th. They are then holding a teach-in at the Chicago Freedom School from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. on the 17th, and then they will hold an action on April 19th, demanding that Pritzker stop funding Boeing's drone facility. And then finally, on April 17th is Palestinian Prisoners Day, and there are a number of events that are happening, and there'll probably be another strike planned for that day. Honestly, it's barely a fraction of all the events planned, and if your social media isn't currently full of events and ways you can support Palestine, then I really can't help you. But we need to keep being loud. We need to keep talking about it on social media. We need to keep calling our Congress members. We need to keep protesting Biden. We need to keep the pressure on. Because this isn't going to stop. I mean, it didn't stop with all of us protesting. It's not going to stop just because we stopped protesting. You know what I mean? We have to keep the support strong for Palestine. And now it's time to talk about the provisional government's failed attempts to avoid civil war. On April 14th, 1922, Rory O'Connor and 200 other anti-treaty men took the forecourts in central Dublin. They took the courts to protest the provisional government's support of the Anglo-Irish Treaty, the creation of the National Army at Bedford's Bush, and the decision to place the fate of the treaty and the future of Ireland in the hands of the Irish people during the general election. Despite Britain's startled response to the takeover, the provisional government was content to let Rory and his men sit in the courts. Members of the provisional government, like Collins and Mulcahy, truly believed they could reach an understanding with the anti-treaty forces, while others, like Griffith, Cosgrave, and O'Higgins, were less optimistic, but equally distracted by the many other pressing needs of the government. In some ways, they were also stonewalled by the growing legacy, power, and prestige of the chairman of the provisional government, Collins. Basically, whatever Collins said went. While Collins pinned his hopes of a peaceful settlement on a general election, and Mulcahy pinned his hopes on quote-unquote loyal IRA men like Liam Lynch, the British government sent letter after letter to Griffith and Collins demanding they crush the quote-unquote rebels in the four courts, or they would. Part 1. Averting war through election rigging and a pro-Republican constitution. With very few exceptions, no one in Ireland wanted to fight each other. The period between January 1922 to June 1922 was spent in various negotiations, meetings, and conventions in an attempt to reach peace, but all attempts failed. Still, even while Rory O'Connor, Liam Mellows, even Liam Lynch went around the country preparing for war, Collins was confident he could keep Ireland together through a combination of a pro-treaty victory in a general election and the publication of the Irish Constitution. His plan was to publish the Irish Constitution first, and then hold the general elections. He firmly believed that his constitution would be Republican enough to win over many of the anti-treaty IRA diehards, and at that point, anyone who still didn't accept the treaty and the constitution would be minimalized and they wouldn't cause as much damage. The constitution he was currently writing, in addition to all his other responsibilities, was going to negate many of the treaty terms Collins agreed to with the British, including the absence of any mention of an oath of loyalty to the monarchy. He was confident he could get the British to approve the pro-Republican constitution, considering the deteriorating situation in Ireland. Part 1A, the Electoral Pact. Before Collins could share the constitution, he needed to be able to hold elections. The British government wanted the elections to be held sooner rather than later, and Griffith agreed. Griffith wanted an election held no later than June. To hold an election, the provisional government's forces needed to be able to guarantee they could protect the election polls and officers. Because you have to remember, the election's being organized while Rory holds the Four Courts, so he took the Four Courts. Collins is planning an invasion of Northern Ireland. Collins and Coe are writing the state constitution. O'Higgins and Cosgrave are trying to resurrect the justice system and the home offices. Mulcahy is still meeting with anti-treaty IRA members. He's holding and canceling army conventions. He's building a national army. And then the new police force, the Civic Guard, are inching towards mutiny, which is being driven by anti-treaty men who aren't connected with Rory and his attempt to hold the Four Courts. Okay, and that's like a fraction of everything that's going on. That's just like a hint, because we've talked about other things too. Because Protestants are being attacked. There's growing chaos in areas where the IRC have already retreated from their barracks. The British soldiers are pulling out, except for 5,000 soldiers in Dublin under the command of General Macready. And already the British are looking at Ireland and they're like, oh man, do we have to recommit more forces? Or is the provisional government going to get its shit together in time? So there's a lot going on. And a lot is riding both on the constitution and the ability to hold a general election. So with all this in mind, Collins reached out to De Valera and created the Electoral Pact. Basically, they agreed to divvy up the Dáil seats in proportion to the treaty vote that happened in December. So the treaty was approved by the Dáil with 64 in favor and 57 against. Not only was Collins willing to rig the general election, he also said that the split would be artificially preserved. So this was something that was going to continue. It wasn't even a one-time thing. At some point, maybe the anti-treaty and pro-treaty side, they wouldn't need the division anymore, but for the foreseeable future, this is how elections were going to go. It seems that neither men thought the rest of Ireland would be upset with perpetual election rigging. Collins certainly didn't expect Griffith's soul to shatter when the pact was brought before the cabinet for approval. According to Ernest Blyth, when Griffith was asked to approve the pact, he, quote, worked nervously with his necktie in silence. He took off his glasses and wiped them. His hand was shaking so that he could hardly hold them. And quote is from Charles Townshend's book, The Republic. He remained silent for 3 minutes before he finally agreed to the pact. Afterwards, he never referred to Collins as Mick or Collins again, only as Mr. Collins. It's really sad when you consider that negotiating with the British brought Griffith and Collins closer together. And then, like, what is it? 4 months later, the British and the treaty drive them apart. Part 1b, the Irish Constitution. With the Electoral Pact signed and agreed upon, Collins worked with a drafting committee to write a Republican constitution. This constitution was important enough to convince anti-treaty IRA men like Liam Lynch and Frank Atkins to pause hostilities until the constitution could be reviewed. So Collins was like making a really big deal about how Republican this constitution was going to be and how he was right the entire time to agree to the treaty because the constitution would give Ireland the rights that the treaty didn't. Lynch was so convinced that he wrote to his brother on March 6th, quote, if we can force the treaty party to draw up a Republican constitution, we are A1 again, which Lynch thought was, quote-unquote, quite possible, end quote is from Charles Townshend's book, The Republic. The Constitution Committee wrote 3 different drafts, Draft A, Draft B, and Draft C. Collins went with Draft B, which included the proposal for an upper house, which would be the Senate, an executive that contained non-elected ministers, and didn't mention the oath at all. It also included a preamble about dedication to Ireland and republicanism, and there was a clause that stated that the power of the government came from the Irish people. There was no mention of the monarchy. Collins severely underestimated the anger and fear in the English government at this time. First, they were furious over the Electoral Pact. They told Collins it was unacceptable as they couldn't accept a government where half the members didn't accept the treaty. Which, to be fair, made sense. One can imagine Collins' reaction to Britain's refusal to support the one thing that could avoid a civil war. One can also imagine the work Collins had to do to get De Valera to agree to an idea that wasn't his. His mood rapidly deteriorated when Britain also rejected his proposed constitution. Now this really pissed the British off. Lloyd George wrote, it was a, quote, complete evasion of the treaty and the setting up of a republic with a thin veneer. He claimed that the constitution would turn the British Empire into a laughingstock and ignored the principle of a unified Commonwealth foreign policy. End quote is from Charles Townshend's book, The Republic. So instead of taking the long view, instead of stepping back and thinking about what was going on in Ireland, the British government was determined to force a formal acknowledgement of the monarchy's power over Ireland. They were willing to risk Civil War, they were willing to risk the treaty, they were willing to risk war again with England and Ireland over this stupid oath and over Ireland admitting that they still belong to the British Empire. Basically, the English didn't want to admit what De Valera would prove true by 1937. They had lost enough control of Ireland to not really have any claim over the island, ignoring Northern Ireland. That's a different situation. Desperate not to appear impotent and to save face over losing a piece of quote-unquote their empire, the British bullishly focused on symbolism, hoping that that would be enough to retain control over all of Ireland. The British government clearly still didn't understand the Irish people very well. Collins was furious. He claimed, quote, "A few months ago, we could have got a constitution on practically definitely Gaelic lines. The first was made impossible by the actions and attitude of the opposition. Suspicions of the British were aroused, and more unfortunately, our weakness fully shown up. If the whole of nationalist Ireland had had the simple honesty to accept the treaty for what it was worth, I believe we would have got a Gaelic constitution based on the fact of our freedom and our general authority that the British would have to acquiesce." And quote is from Bill Kissane's book, The Politics of the Irish Civil War. Part 1C, The General Election. Collins was so disgusted with the entire affair and knew that the new, neutered constitution was no longer the saving grace he had promised it would be, printed the constitution the day of the general election. To make matters worse, because of British pressure, Collins could not support the electoral pact publicly. While he didn't completely negate the pact, he told voters in court on the eve of the election to, quote, vote for the candidates you think best of, and would, quote, carry on best in the future the work they want carried on. The next day, he told voters in his hometown to support the pact in, quote, the spirit in which it was made, and that it was, quote, their duty to vote for people they thought would carry out that policy. And both quotes are from Charles Townshend's book, The Republic. Altogether, the pro-treaty Sinn Féin deputies, combined with Labour, the Farmers' Party, and the Independent deputies, brought the pro-treaty majority to 92 out of 128 seats, with 78% of the votes cast. The election results were devastating to the anti-treaty supporters of Ireland. Dorothy McArdle, a famous writer and anti-treaty supporter, wrote that the election result was, quote, not only the end of the Irish Republic, but the end of republicanism in Ireland. And quote was from Charles Townshend's book, The Republic. Matters would grow worse for the anti-treaty side, because not only did they lose the general election, they were also splintering, because they didn't know how to respond to the provisional government's actions. So Rory still has the four courts, still hanging out there, but what's going on there? What is he doing? He's just, right now he's just sitting in the courts. It's not really doing anything. Liam Lynch is on the fence. He still wants to leave in Collins and Mulcahy, but he can't bring himself to support a treaty that requires an oath to the monarchy, and he thinks that the provisional government isn't republican enough. But again, what is he doing? There's not really a grand strategy being designed. He's not really recruiting or unifying commands at all. And then finally you have Tom Barry, who's just like, let's just screw it. Like, fuck it. Let's send an ultimatum to the British forces demanding that they evacuate Ireland within 72 hours or there would be war. Not quite sure what forces Tom thought he had to fight the British, especially if the provisional government was still determined to respect the treaty. That would have been civil war anyway. But he threw the idea out there and the idea was voted down. However, Barry and a minority, they broke away from the anti-treaty IRA thinking that they were too soft and they weren't going to, you know, do what needed to be done to protect republicanism and a free Ireland. So they created their own IRA with their own chief of staff to replace Liam Lynch. So now the anti-treaty IRA are split. And the provisional government knows about this. They know the treaty, the anti-IRA treaty sides are splintering. And there's hope there. Because again, the whole idea is just to get enough of the anti-treaty diehards to join the provisional government, and then everyone else can just be neutralized because they're just going to be a small minority. So there's hope within the provisional government that this might actually be a good sign. Part 2. The provisional government forced into action. No one told the British that this was a good sign. For Britain, things were looking terrible in Ireland, and they were very eager to take aggressive action against the anti-treaty forces. Churchill bombarded Griffith with letter after letter after letter demanding action. And in one particularly hysterical letter, he claimed, quote, "Rich and poor turned out of their homes on 2 hours' notice, leaving behind them the inheritance of generations and generations. The cattle are killed, the lonely white peacocks hunted to death. Some of the scenes are like those of the French Revolution. Until somehow or another we find a means of putting an end to this state of affairs, our boast of civilization in these islands is stultified." So, you know, a lot going on in that quote. But also, leaving behind inheritance of generations and generations. Most of the people being turned out at this point are Protestants, or they're IRC men, right? They're people that are identified one way or another as pro-treaty, pro-treaty, pro-British forces. We talked about this in my episode about the Protestants of Ireland. So the inheritance that some of these people are leaving behind, because not everyone was Protestant or pro-treaty or whatever, came because they took it from the Irish people. So, you know, there's a lot of gray there that Churchill's not acknowledging. Also, I'm not sure what he means by the lonely white peacocks. If anyone knows what that means, I would love to learn. I didn't know there were white peacocks in Ireland at the time. And actually, it's kind of funny, too, that he evokes the French Revolution, because O'Higgins later would claim that the Irish Revolution was the most conservative revolution. So, this is a lot. There's a lot going on in that quote. I find it kind of funny. I guess it would be funny if the consequences weren't so severe. Part 2A, the assassination of Henry Wilson. The British reached their official breaking point with the assassination of Henry Wilson. Wilson's reputation and legacy is tied to his assassination. He's been turned into a martyr by certain elements in Ireland and Britain, but at the time he was considered to be a troublemaker and a pretty big opponent to Irish republicanism. His history is very conflicted, I think I would say. He didn't do anything to suppress the Ulster Volunteers in 1913. He supported the conscription of Irish people during World War I. In 1919, he wrote that, quote, "a little bloodletting was needed in Ireland," and when the truce was agreed to, he wrote that it was rank, filthy cowardice, and he didn't support the Anglo-Irish Treaty at all. When De Valera was supposed to come to London, Wilson told Lloyd George that he, quote, "did not speak to murderers," and that he would arrest De Valera the moment he stepped foot on British soil. Lloyd George supposedly replied, "oh, nonsense, in public life we must do these things." And that quote is from Keith Jeffrey's book, Field Marshal Sir Henry Wilson, a Political Soldier. Apparently, this broke the relationship between Lloyd George and Wilson, which was already a little rocky, and Wilson resigned from the army and ran for election in February 1922. He was determined to overthrow Lloyd George's government. After resigning, Wilson advised the Northern Ireland government on security, encouraging Craig to recruit loyal Catholics and Protestants into the force. As if you've listened to my episode of Northern Ireland, you will know that Craig ignored him and focused on recruiting Protestants only. And to appoint an army commander over the police force to ensure discipline. Wilson didn't want a repeat of the Black and Tans or the auxiliaries. Given Wilson's history and his firm beliefs in a British empire, he was seen as a key instigator of violence in Northern Ireland, with Collins calling him, quote, "a violent orange partisan." Wilson was shot outside his house at 36 Eaton Place on June 22, 1922. He was in full uniform and received 6 wounds in total to the chest. Only 2 were fatal. His assassins, Reginald Dunn and Joseph O'Sullivan, were arrested on the same day, but only after intense struggle and the wounding of a chauffeur and at least 4 other police officers. Dunn and O'Sullivan were hung on August 10th, 1922. Dunn said before his execution that Wilson, quote, "was at the time of his death the military advisor to what is colloquially called the Ulster government, and as military advisor he raised and organized a body of men known as the Ulster Special Constabulary, who were the principal agents in his reign of terror." And this quote is from John J. Edelston's book, Foul Deeds in Kensington and Chelsea. Reginald Dunn and Joseph O'Sullivan were members of the anti-treaty IRA, and it's unclear to this day if anyone ordered the assassination, or if it was a lone but desperate attempt by Dunn and O'Sullivan to provoke Britain to invade and unite Ireland again once more against the ground forces. There are scholars to this day who believe Collins may have been responsible for Wilson's death. Of course, this doesn't make sense if Collins was dedicated to avoiding war with Britain and upholding the treaty. However, we must remember that Collins and Mulcahy were coordinating a northern offensive with Frank Atkins and other northern IRA units to, quote-unquote, protect the northern Catholics, and maybe unite the anti-treaty and pro-treaty forces in an offensive to, quote-unquote, take back the north. Assassinating key northern leaders made sense if a massive offensive was in place. But we also know that the northern offensive sputtered into a disaster for key anti-treaty units. The pro-treaty units weren't involved, and many of them were called back. Partly because Rory took four courts, but also partly because it was clear that the northern offensive wasn't going to work, and Ireland just had its own problems with a civil war on the horizon. So it was called off. So if the offensive wasn't happening, why was Wilson assassinated at all? There are, like, many reasons why Wilson could potentially have been assassinated. It's possible the assassination of Wilson was part of the plans for the northern offensive, and even though Collins didn't give the order, Dunn and O'Sullivan knew about the plan to assassinate him, and so they decided to follow through anyway, maybe even to trigger Collins to support the northern offensive more. Maybe it was supposed to be a signal or something, who knows. However, if Wilson was a target, then Collins only shared that information with certain IRA members, because when Tobin, who is part of the squad, told Mulcahy, one of our quote-unquote boys, killed Wilson, Mulcahy was horrified, and he was determined to resign. Tobin told Collins about Mulcahy's reaction, and Collins sorted things out. We don't know what that means, but Mulcahy didn't resign. Mulcahy's reaction either reveals A, he didn't know that Wilson was ever going to be assassinated, B, he knew Wilson's assassination had been discussed, but assumed no one was actually going to kill him because the northern offensive was basically abandoned by himself and Collins, C, he knew about the potential for Wilson's assassination and was horrified that Collins gave the order without telling him, and his offer to resign was as much an act of frustration that there were things Collins still wasn't telling him, even if those orders could jeopardize the Irish Free State, which was the whole fucking point of the treaty and everything. And even if Collins didn't give the actual order, the fact that anti-treaty IRA men were acting out on a quote-unquote proposed order that could be traced back to Collins and the provisional government should have been troubling for the provisional government. Maybe it was for Mulcahy, and again, maybe that's why he offered to resign. We may never know whether Collins was involved with the assassination or not. What we do know is that it was the final straw for the British. After the assassination, Lloyd George sent a letter to the provisional government stating, quote, "The ambiguous position of the Irish Republican Army can no longer be ignored by the British government. Still less can Mr. Rory O'Connor be permitted to remain with his followers and his arsenal in open rebellion in the heart of Dublin. Organizing and sending out from this center enterprises of murder not only in the area of your government, but also in the six northern counties and in Great Britain. His Majesty's government cannot consent to a continuation of this state of things." End quote is from Charles Townshend's book, The Republic. The provisional government never responded to the letter, and Lloyd George ordered General McCready to clear the four courts of the anti-treaty IRA. McCready, maybe the only Englishman with a lick of common sense at the time, argued against these orders, stating that the cabinet's, quote, "ignorance of the Irish situation blinded them to the possible results." Quote is from Charles Townshend's book, The Republic. What was he talking about? So you gotta think, right? British troops, for the most part, they've left Ireland. The provisional government is supposed to be this government that has taken over for now, and then once the general election is held, then a formal government's going to take over. It's supposed to be very democratic, it's supposed to be very smooth, it's supposed to be an example of why you want to stay in the Commonwealth. You know, it's going to normalize relations between Britain and Ireland. You now have Rory in the four courts, you've got the civil guard mutiny going on, you've got whatever negotiations may still be taking place between the provisional government and the anti-treaty IRA members. The northern offensive is sputtering to its finish. There's still, you know, chaos in the farmlands of Ireland. Protestants and IRC men, they're still trying to find a way back to England, or they're sending petitions for help, or they're sending petitions for damages, you know, for payment for damages. Things aren't looking well. That is true. However, could you imagine the reaction if British soldiers fired upon Irish rebels in the four courts in the heart of Dublin? If you listened to my episode on Easter Rising, you will know that the Four Courts was also held by Irish rebels in 1916, and it was also bombarded by British artillery and soldiers. And those rebels were arrested and executed, along with the other rebels of Easter Rising. So what MacCready realizes is that if he fires upon the Four Courts, it's Easter Rising all over again. Like, it has the potential of being Easter Rising all over again. Also, if he doesn't even tell the provisional government he's doing it, he's going to piss off the provisional government, again, jeopardizing England's pseudo-relation with that body of government. MacCready doesn't really think well of the Irish, so he thinks that the provisional government is more likely to side with the anti-treaty side. They just need an excuse, basically. But he's also not stupid. He's not going to risk 5,000 of his men if he doesn't have to. So he's, like, trying to talk Lloyd George's government from off the ledge. Like, please don't have me restart this fucking conflict. Let the Irish kill each other. Don't send more British troops to Ireland, right? Let them have their civil war. Let them figure it out. I don't want to be involved in this. Part 2b. A kidnapping sparks an artillery bombardment. Griffith, Eamon Dalton, who was part of the National Army, and MacCready were in the midst of negotiations regarding weapons in case the provisional government needed to clear the courts out. Like, Griffith was done with Rory. He had been done with Rory since the Four Courts were taken, but Collins and Mulcahy had decided to be patient, let's not overreact, let's not force things, we've got a lot of things going on, right? But Griffith had been ready. And Griffith was becoming increasingly convinced that Collins wasn't going to do what needed to be done to stop the rebellion. And so he was already in negotiations with Britain about, like, what they needed to hold the state, because the Irish National Army, they didn't have anything, because the IRA didn't have anything. Everything that they had, they stole from the British. These negotiations were already in place, and like I said, Lloyd George and Churchill had been sending letter after letter to the provisional government to do something, but the government was hesitant. Understandably so. The provisional government felt that if they were going to shoot at their own people, they wanted it to be on their own terms. Not because the British cabinet was upset about one of their own being assassinated. And oh, by the way, Wilson was helping the Ulster government retain Protestant dominance in Northern Ireland, right? Wilson had been helping the Ulster volunteers back in 1913. Wilson didn't believe in an Irish Republic. So, like, you know, Ireland's not going to shed any tears for him, and that the provisional government isn't going to kill their own for him, especially since Collins may have been involved with his assassination in the first place. However, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on where you stand on the issue, the anti-treaty IRA gave the provisional government the perfect excuse they needed to clear out the courts when they kidnapped pro-treaty officer J.J. Ginger O'Connell. They kidnapped him because one of their own members had been arrested earlier while carrying out a raid against a company that was still selling goods from Northern Ireland. You know, back in the Irish War of Independence, the IRA tried to implement a Belfast boycott. Didn't really work, but the anti-treaty IRA were determined to restart it, again, as a whole thing to unite Ireland and to take back Northern Ireland, and it wasn't really well thought out. But anyway, one of their own was kidnapped while raiding a company that wasn't honoring the boycott, so they kidnapped O'Connell. They didn't know that the British government had been petitioning the pro-treaty side to do something. They didn't know that they had basically signed their own death warrants by kidnapping O'Connell. Late June 27th, early June 28th, the provisional government sent a warning to the garrison in the Four Courts. The government told them to surrender their arms and O'Connell and evacuate the courts, or military action would be taken. Griffith told MacCready to take the courts, and he gave overall command to Emmett Dalton. Dalton was a World War I veteran with real combat experience. He knew that he could not take the Four Courts with a direct assault with the troops he had, and he wasn't going to get British support because, again, that negated the whole idea of Ireland being its own independent entity. And he also knew how terrifying an artillery bombardment could be, even for veterans. Dalton's plan was to use the artillery Britain gave to the provisional government to terrify and bombard the anti-treaty IRA forces into submission. The first cannon fired during the early morning hours on June 28th. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. You can listen to my full catalog on Spotify, iTunes, and my website, www.samswarroom.com. Don't forget to sign up for the Around the World Book Club, also on my website. For April, we'll be reading Before the Next Bomb Drops by Remy Kanazi and Blood Orange by Yaffa. Until next time, wear a mask, demand a ceasefire in Palestine, and stay safe.